Possibilities.
Collaborative.
Collaboration.
Positive and optimistic.
Expanding.
Pure life.
So welcome to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change, produced by At the Epicenter. I'm Selene Diaris, the founder and executive director of At the Epicenter. And today I am very privileged to be having a conversation with David Bronner, the Cosmic Engagement Officer for Dr. Bronner's. David, thank you so much for joining us today for a conversation about all sorts of dynamic things that tickle your brain and are what your company is doing in the world.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
It's really exciting. So you were sharing just when we were just having a little conversation before we went live about some of the men in your family who are sort of the progenitors of Dr. Bronner's. You want to just share those pictures again or stories about how everything started?
Well, yeah. Well, here, you know what I'm going to have to do? I'm going to have to take a picture of my computer because it's so dope because you won't be able to see it. But this is what our IT did. And then I'll show you this. So that's Dr. Bronner. I don't know if you can kind of see.
Oh, cool.
My computer's got like a rainbow phasing pattern of Dr. Bronner.
That's so neat.
Yeah. So I've got, you know, Dr. Bronner, like my granddad, just right there. And then my other ancestral lineage. So my dad, Jim Bronner. and my uncle, Ralph Bronner.
Awesome. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I check in, you know, pretty much every day. And, you know, most of the time they're like, yeah, right on. Keep going there, son. You know, and sometimes we're like, you know.
Well, but, it wouldn't be keeping it interesting if they were agreeing with you every moment, right?
Yeah, no, totally. So, you know, obviously my granddad was, founded Dr. Bronner's in 1948. Do you want me to go into that history or?
Absolutely.
Sure. Okay. So my granddad, was a third generation soap maker from a German Jewish soap making family. His grandfather began making soap in a small German town of Laupheim in 1858. And in a house in the Jewish quarter there that we actually recently bought in the past 12 months, purchased our ancestral home there. And it's gonna be, it's like some kind of cool museum slash home for like disabled folks, and it's like a really, really cool thing. And then his son Bertolt, and three sons. So my granddad's dad Bertolt, so my great grandfather, and my granddad's two uncles. So my great grandfather and his two brothers were running the operation in the second generation, and built the family business up to become the largest soap maker in Germany, basically. And they had a factory in Heilbronn, another city in southern Germany, kind of in the manufacturing part, or one of the three big manufacturing areas of Germany. And we were supplying liquid soaps in all the public washrooms, and we had a brand called Made of Foam, which was a play of the English Made of Foam, kind of a German alliteration, Made of Foam. Mm-hmm. And so my granddad, Dr. Bronner, came up in the guild system at the time and was apprenticed to another soap-making family. And then went to work in the family enterprise, but was constantly clashing with his dad and uncles. My granddad was very Zionist and activist, and his dad was, you know, really didn't want my granddad mixing politics and soap, and just keep it down. And there's just a lot of generational clash between my dad, or granddad, and his dad, my great grandfather Bertolt, and. So Dr. Bronner immigrated to the United States in 1929 at the age of 21 and became a consultant to the U.S. soap industry. He landed in Chicago, and he didn't leave because of Hitler or Nazism. That was just in the early stages. It was, the eventual dimensions were not clear. It was more just a generational clash with his family.
Right.
And so he was making a living helping like the P&Gs of the world build factories and launch products, and married his wife and Paula, my dad's mom Paula, and had three children in the 30s. My dad Jim, Uncle Ralph, and Aunt Ellen. But then also was becoming increasingly desperate with the rise of Hitler to get his parents out. And his two sisters got out. My great aunt Lottie got out in 36 at the age of 20 and ended up in the Engev kibbutz in Israel. And then Louisa got out in 38, became a professor in German. Came to the US. And she became a professor, ultimately became a professor of German at UMass Boston, but before that was a chemist and developed a waterproofing compound for American GIs going into Korea, but got no credit as a woman, quit in disgust, and went and got her PhD, and then wrote poetry in Hebrew and German and English about really grappling with the fate of her parents and the culture she was destroying.
So they all perished in Nazi Germany, the family?
Her parents, so Bertolt and Franziska, like a lot of the bourgeois Jews, thought they were going to ride out the madness, and it was too late. And then in 1940, the factory was Aryanized, and they were deported and killed in 42 and 44. So my granddad's response to all that was to, was that somehow in the midst of all this tragedy, and also Paula, his wife, died in the same time frame, got sick and died. And so he's just dealing with immense personal tragedy. And his response to this was to somehow, in the midst of all this, he was having these huge mystical experiences of the deep love and light at the heart of reality, and that but also desperately concerned that in a nuclear armed world in the post-World War II era, that the next Holocaust, if we don't realize our transcendent unity across religious and ethnic divides and the one true religion of love that lies at the heart of all the faith traditions, if we don't tap into that, then the next Holocaust,
we're all going to be gone.
So he felt called to go forth and lecture and promote his peace plan and this vision of the moral ABC, and went around the country lecturing and then selling his natural soaps on the side, his family's natural soaps, which were based on like an old original soap chemistry, very biodegradable and ecological, the way soaps have been made for thousands of years. And he early on saw the dangers of better living through chemistry in the post-World War II era, like all the transition of industry to petrochemicals and in agriculture, starting to use synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and all these petrochemical products were basically poisons and toxins as part of, what do you call it, chemical warfare.
And I just want to interrupt you there just momentarily. And just for some folks listening, they may not even know the connection between the chemicals that are now so widely used in agriculture really came out of war development and chemicals being created for war. So it's pretty strange that we started using these things to grow our food when they were being designed to do damage as part of the war machine.
Yeah, they're basically these potent nerve toxins, and then they became, they were originally used in warfare and then adapted to become pesticides and insecticides. And yeah, it's just kind of crazy. And, it's like, fast forward to Vietnam and you got all these like defoliants, like Agent Orange that, became herbicides in U.S. agriculture.
Well, and we're reusing some of the more horrible ones right now because GMO crops have become basically immune to the original host of chemicals being sprayed on them. So now we're even pulling out bigger guns.
Right. I mean, we're engineering our major food crops to withstand huge amounts of first glyphosate, and that's supposed to solve all our problems, but the weeds are now resistant. The super weeds aren't killed by glyphosate, so now we're engineering resistance to dicamba and 2,4-D, and 2,4-D is one half of Agent Orange. And so we're just, we're on this chemical treadmill with agriculture, and So my granddad early on saw the dangers of this pivot to just kind of over-reliance on petrochemicals and synthetic chemistry and, you know, the nitrogen, the way we make synthetic nitrogen is through the Haber-Bosch process. And it takes something like 3% of the world's entire energy demand is used to make this one fertilizer. It's this incredibly energy intensive process. And so he was going around like kind of lecturing on this peace plan and on the virtues of a simpler life. And it was with the, and he was noticing people were coming more to buy the soaps he was selling on the side than to hear what he had to say.
He probably didn't like that so much.
Well, you know, but he,
or was it a mix for him?
Well, you know, he made it into an opportunity and downloaded what he had to say on the labels of the soap. So that's
the origin. Dr. Bronner labels.
Yeah, and then it's brilliant because you go in the bathroom, you forget a magazine, and there's some soap. He's got you, you know.
Yeah, I have to just tell you, my husband, when I told him I was going to have a conversation with you, he was like, when he was a boy and his family went camping here in the Rocky Mountains, Dr. Bronner's was the soap, and they bathed in it, they washed their dishes in it, and then around the campfire, they would read the label and talk about all of the different messaging on the label, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, and that's, you know, and especially with the rise of the counterculture and the hippie generation and wholesale, like, you know, this is the era of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's, like, all the birds are dying, they're dead, their song is no more because of the rampant, persistent pesticides that don't just kill in the, on the fields, but they just keep killing to get into the ecosystem.
Absolutely.
And we're living through the sixth great extinction event, like a comet's hitting the planet. I mean, it's in slow motion, but in geological time, it's happening real fast. All these ecosystems are in collapse, and agriculture is like a big part of it, or the way we're practicing it. And so he really imparted that ethic into the company. The company for him was an engine to leverage for social and environmental change. He ran it as a nonprofit religious organization. The IRS disagreed with his tax-exempt status, and we were in court, and he lost, and we had to pay huge amounts of bank back taxes and penalties. And my dad and uncle entered the picture at that point, my dad Jim and Uncle Ralph, and my mom Trudy, to kind of, my granddad had gotten sick. It was like the late 80s. He had Parkinson's and was slowing down. And had all these bad advisors, and my dad, mom, and Uncle Ralph got in, kind of stabilized the ship, fired all the bad advisors, and we exited bankruptcy as a for-profit, but had this nonprofit DNA at the heart of everything we do.
Yeah, and, you guys are amazing.
Yeah, and I came up with my dad. I mean, my granddad wasn't the best father; kind of went off to save the world, and my dad and uncle came up in a series of foster homes and.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty interesting part of the story.
Yeah, and so my dad, you know, he went to the Navy when he was like 17, and when he came out, he worked for my granddad for a bit, but it was just very difficult. And my granddad came down in the San Diego area in Escondido in the early 60s. My dad stayed up in LA and kind of rose up through the ranks of a chemical specialty manufacturer that my granddad was running a reactor out to on the weekends to make our soap. So my dad stayed there and basically became the head operations of that facility and continued to oversee the bulk manufacture of Dr. Bronner soap, but was also doing a bunch of other stuff, including developing firefighting foam for forest and structure fires. And when the Forest Service was testing the firefighting foam, just to make sure it wasn't going to kill and, you know, be more of a problem and was biodegradable, which it is, and it's totally fine. It looks like a blizzard hit the forest. There's a lot of reasons for firefighting foam in a low visibility forest fire. You can see where you drop the water. Foam sticks the water up on vertical surfaces. It wets it out so it can penetrate fuels and insulates fuels from radiant heat. But it looks like snow. And so then my dad developed a vision for Hollywood. So me and my brother grew up going foaming Alka-Seltzer sets and movie sets and in Hollywood.
That's interesting. I didn't know that part of the story that you were, that was part of its use.
Well, guess who the firefighting foam he developed a firefighting foam for Monsanto's firefighting division.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So I grew up going to Monsanto's firefighting division, you know, testing out the foam. And Monsanto ended up spinning that, you know, they spun off all their whatever divisions and just became an ag chemical company. You know, very problematic entity, but kind of like a country. They got a whole bunch of stuff, you know.
That's right.
But it was this kind of ironic history that I have with.
It is ironic, David. I had no idea.
Yeah. This whole time, man, I've been in working. No. Anyways, so. Yeah.
We thought you were doing this other thing.
No. Well, I got the poetry of it, you know, kind of helping lead the, you know, GMO labeling and just, you know, and just otherwise, like, this whole. Yeah. So, I mean, fast forward. So my dad was basically running both this foam business that me and my brother were working in, and then also stepped in to run Dr. Bronner's when my granddad's health was failing. And through the 90s, my mom and my uncle Ralph were running it. Mm. And then my dad got, so, and I went through a series of big awakenings and at post-college and some pretty powerful psychedelic experiences opened me up, and I finally understood what my granddad was talking about. I mean, as a kid, it was sailing over my head, you know, like, we must unite this spaceship Earth, you know, like, what, you know, like, but.
Recite this for me.
Yeah, well, luckily he was blind, so I could read off the label.
Read it off the label?
Yeah, and it really impressed him. He's like, very good, very good. But and that's what one of the jokes is, our label is designed by a blind man. Like, he didn't know how busy he was getting, you know.
That's actually really fetching, isn't it? That aspect, that his failing sight created the extraordinariness of that label, which is so
unique. You know, I mean, even this, I mean, it violates every single rule of design, you know, but it just works. Right? It just like pops.
It's worked for Dr. Bronner's, that's for sure. Yeah. It's an iconic. I mean, everybody who has any connection to soaps and what their option are, I don't know many people that haven't encountered the product and remember it for that label.
Yeah, and it just kind of reads like a kind of old apothecary look and feel. You know, even just on the shelf, it's got a good vibration, and
I love that you guys have kept it all these years. You know, I think that just speaks so much to the devotion to the origination of the company and the intention, and that I think is a really, it's beautiful.
Yeah, no, thank you, and you know, but it did take some pretty mega experiences of dying into the light and love somehow at the heart of this, you know, reality that's often absurd and tragic and horrible. Also beautiful and wonderful, but that indeed there is a deep, you know, the deepest truth is the light and the love, and that's at the heart of it somehow. And I was, you know, was able to come back and tell my granddad, like, wow, I fully get it. I understand. I'm going to dedicate my life to what you're trying to do. And was, you know, I became a mental health counselor, and it was kind of like a long journey. Became, adopted a vegan diet, and just kind of really started, you know, understanding the scale of impact of Western consumptive culture on the planet and disconnection from the natural world and from our deeper self.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second here, David, and say, you know, when you're talking about like what this deeper core of potential is, for me, the regenerative framework is part of that conversation being re-elevated.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, my journey is, eventually I got to a place of, So I guess my dad died in, well, my granddad died in 97 on the same day my daughter was born, March 7th, 97. And then my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer shortly thereafter, and got a year with him to really, like, for him to download the ropes on me and, you know, just really train me up and get me ready. And then he died June 12th of 98 on Uncle Ralph's birthday.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so one of the first things, you know, but I came in to Bronner's like, we're going to be activists, just like, you know, my granddad, you know, that we're here to make the world better. But, you know, my dad was the central moral inspiration. My dad was not into the cosmic vision. He was kind of rejected that as like an escape from your immediate responsibilities. Like, you need to focus on what's in front of you and do what you can to help the people and be practical and what can you do. And he was such a moral man and just like got after it and made so many beautiful things happen for his family, for us, and for his community. So really set the example. And in fact, right before he died, we donated 1,000 acres of land in East County, San Diego that my granddad had. And he had this vision of kind of reforesting this semi-arid land and creating climatic instability and bring rainfall to Southern California. So it wasn't working out. And my dad wanted to give that to the Boys and Girls Club. And all our advisors like, man, you don't do that. You have this huge estate taxes. That's like 1/3 of your entire like worth. And like, my dad was like insisting on it. It was like, and we did it. And he really set the example. Like, this is what we do. And it was kind of cool, full circle, because there was these youth programs that helped him. Like these
right. men
that I don't know who they were that helped my dad become the giant that he was. And so one big part of our philanthropy is to youth programs. But, you know, my dad set that example, and then we adopted a 5-to-1 salary cap with, you know, and vowed like all of our profits we don't need for the company, we're going to put into the causes we believe in. And one of the first things we did is put hemp in. And hemp is like a really perfect, you know, it's right at the intersection of sustainable agriculture and drug reform, drug policy reform. You know, it was kind of a way of, you know, promoting, you know, it grows like a weed. It doesn't need as much synthetic input.
Oh, it grows like a weed. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
And gee, wonder how it got its other name, weed.
Yeah, no, I know. But that ties together the twin passion projects of my life, which is regenerative organic agriculture and integration of cannabis and psychedelic allies. And hemp was kind of like the first thing, and kind of it's interesting how it's come, just kind of putting that together. But
yeah, and it's interesting how there's been in not a very long period of time such a rapid revolution for hemp as, you know, the plant on the hemp side, and then cannabis as well, both of which are phenomenal allies for humanity. We can create so many ingredients and fibers and products out of the hemp plant itself. And of course, we can talk about the inspirational gifts of cannabis directly, but well, we can talk about that.
Oh, in fact, you know what? I don't, because guess what? My hat is Sun and Earth certified. So just kind of leaping ahead, you know, so this is a program. It's the regenerative organic for high THC cannabis. Because of federal prohibition, for a long time, not even hemp could access the USDA organic program. But that finally, we sorted that out. But it's still the case for marijuana, for the high THC varieties. The farmers who are doing everything right, they can't participate in this like very successful program. I mean, it has its problems, but you know, it's a very effective program to at least convey that you're not using, you know, horrible toxins in your farming practices, but they can't even access that program.
And so, you're talking about the USDA organic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of the federal control of organic, they can't access it. So we came up with a consumer-facing certification called Sun and Earth, and it's kind of the parallel to the regenerative organic effort. Ah. So regenerative organic, you know, that we work with Patagonia and Rodale and Demeter and, you know, leading fair labor organizations and leading animal welfare organizations to kind of bring the best of soil health and animal welfare and fair labor into a single standard. Building on our USDA organic, but knowing that that's more what you shouldn't do, but not what you should do. So regenerative organic is like, this is what you should do as far as your crop rotations and you know, mob grazing and rotational grazing and, you know, just, you know, all the basic soil health practices that you should be doing, not what you shouldn't be doing. And then also layering in pasture-based animal welfare criteria, and then fair labor criteria. So that, you know, that's a huge passion project and effort that's, we're in the pilot. But Sun on Earth is the parallel effort in the cannabis space. So all these, like legalization is like, you got these huge court, the problem of industrial agriculture that has hit every single other legal commodity crop and made a disaster and made the earth, one third of the earth's surface is like a disaster because of agricultural mismanagement. And these huge corporate industrial players come in with these huge plantations and, you know, disrupt ecosystem health, disrupt communities. So that all those same dynamics were playing out in cannabis. Like you're getting these huge corporate indoor grows, you know, just so energy intensive and fossil fuel and pesticide. And this beautiful ecosystem of small family farms, like in Northern California, that have been, a lot of them are back to the land, multi-generational organic pioneers farming cannabis sustainably in a rotation of vegetables and just doing everything beautiful, but they can't, they're not, they have no way of communicating to the customer with any kind of certification program. And so that's where Sun on Earth came in. We like, I mean, there's been some different efforts, but we're bringing together the Cannabis Conservancy that's based out of Colorado and Certified Kind. And that's an Oregon based. And then some other big players like Flocana and Dr. Bronner's, and then all these next level farmers to make Sun on Earth. And that's the basically bringing soil health and fair labor into the cannabis space, you know, in the soil, under the sun, no chemicals, fair labor. So it's nice. Like this new program in the cannabis space that we're promoting. And then there's a brand at Brother David's, and it's not part of Dr. Bronner's, but it's a not-for-profit brand platform. We are working in California only right now, but we're selling cannabis flowers that are Sun on Earth certified and promoting that into the industry and into the trade. And by being not for profit, we're being clear that we want our competitors to be Sun on Earth. It's not about us. We want that to be like the USDA organic Intel Inside baseline for everybody. So we're actively promoting regenerative organic cannabis into the cannabis space. But I mean, that's, I guess maybe a little bit ahead of the story. So,
well, let me just ask you a couple of questions, if I may.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for folks who are listening and you're listening to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change by at the Epicenter, I'm Celine Diaz, and I'm speaking with David Bronner, who is the Cosmic Engagement Officer for Dr. Bronner's. You know, you touched on sort of kind of quickly a little bit about the regenerative organic certification. And I think what might be interesting for us to do is to just get a little deeper into this vision for the regenerative organic certification. And, you know, why did you guys, and this has been a collaborative effort between some really exciting people inside of companies like Patagonia and Dr. Bronner's, and then some nonprofit organizations, the Rodale Institute, which is a longitudinal organization that's been doing, you know, comparative cropping systems between organic and conventional for a very long time, gathering some of the most impactful data that we have about the impacts to place with how you farm. So why regenerative organic, why that path, David?
Yeah, I guess my awakening was, you know, with the rise of the, you know, the launch of the USDA organic program, and then just like kind of coming into the space, you know, a little bit, you know, I was very ecological and social, but pretty naive and ignorant about a lot of the farming practices. And I remember like brands like Guayaquil were coming up at the time, and Guayaquil is this, you know, yerba mate company that has this beautiful business model where they partnered with the Guayaquil tribe in Paraguay that is growing yerba mate sustainably in the rainforest, and by making a sustainable economic living in an ecological way, they've been able to preserve the rainforest and their traditional way of life. And then, you know, selling that to customers in the United States and elsewhere, at a price that can sustain this model. And they're going to market in partnership with their farming community and their farmers who are taking care of their land in a regenerative and responsible way. So, you know, it made me ask, like, okay, well, we're buying our major raw materials on price and spec like everyone else. We have no visibility into where they're coming from. And this is, what are the conditions under which they're being produced? You know, are the farmers being paid fairly? Are their children picking our coconuts? Is rainforest being cleared? You know, I don't know. And unfortunately, that's the game. Like, you buy from these brokers, and that's kind of what's leading. No one's taking responsibility, and it leads to this like out of control, you know, rape of the earth, basically, and very disruptive to the farming communities. And it's kind of a race to the bottom of, like, you know, we see palm plantations ripping up the rainforest in Borneo and Indonesia.
It's tragic.
It's horrible. But what you realize is that agriculture is such a big part of the problem, but it can also be such a big part of the solution. And so, like, by partnering directly with our farming communities, and each of our major raw materials has a cool story. So initially, the story was that we became organic. Like, we did convert and certify organic in 2003, but we realized that just because you're organic, we didn't know
Didn't have transparency in your supply network when you were organic. You just knew you were buying organic. Ingredients. Yeah, okay.
We're still buying from brokers, and it was, you know, we're just like, you know, we want to know. We want to know, like, what's happening. We want to make sure there's no, really problematic labor practices. And so around this time, the tsunami hit Sri Lanka, and one of our aces, Gary Lasson, and we had partnered in hemp, and just on the hemp story, like, we put hemp seed oil in the soaps in 99. Hemp seed oil is really high in omega-3. And there's oil from the seed, not CBD, but the hemp seed oil. And it's very nutritious. American diet is chronically deficient in omega-3. We need to eat fish, certain types of deep sea fish or fish like salmon, whatever, is rich in omega-3, but then there's also mercury and other toxins, concentrate. So it's plant-based.
It's also an exploitation of another species on the planet. What's happening with salmon right now is kind of disturbing with genetic engineering now.
It's a disaster, and so a sustainable plant-based source of omega-3, you know, that was a big market driver for hemp,
right?
And flax, but then it has a really good protein profile. And anyways, in our soaps, it made our lather much smoother and less dry. And now that omega-3 is just really beautiful for making soaps lather, like, just way smoother. So we added the hemp seed oil in 99. In Canada, I just recommercialized hemp in 98, and we thought we were going to be recommercializing here, but then we got Bush, and it was just the 9/11, just this nightmare. We ended up in this big fight with the DEA over whether or not our hemp seed oil was a Schedule I drug, and which we ultimately won. And I was like, and in that fight, we met a lot of the key people who are now our senior management at Ronners. Was kind of forged out of that fight with the DEA. It's like, okay, how do we battle this out-of-control government agency, and how do you do this, and how do you win? Getting the legal strategy and the PR strategy and the grassroots strategy, getting it all together, and just meeting the people who could do it, and, you know, just seeing who's the real aces. So one of those aces was Gary Lasson. He is his PhD, environmental engineer out of Germany, but just really knew his stuff. And he came into hemp through his interest in natural fibers, and was very involved in coconut fiber in Sri Lanka. And so when the tsunami hit, Garo founded a nonprofit called Second Aid, and it was about supporting, rebuilding, like, fishing boats and sewing shops and getting the economy, like, infrastructure restarted, and not just dump a bunch of food and clothes on the situation, but, like, really get in there and, you know, send microloans and just restart the industries. And I said, well, Garrow, you know, we want to go fair trade, and there's so much coconut oil coming out of Sri Lanka. Let's look at buying a coconut mill and partnering with farmers there and do a fair trade coconut project. So one thing led to another, and we and our sister company, Sarah Nepal, was founded in 2007 and is now, and then was producing initially for our soaps, but then we developed a food grade version, or actually we were supposed to be selling it to some other unnamed brand, and that didn't manifest. So then we actually entered the market ourselves with our own branded VCO, and that just blew up.
Yeah, I have that in my kitchen cabinet right now.
Yeah.
Coconut oil, your unrefined organic.
Yeah, and so we like partnered with all these farmers promoting best regenerative practices, like formed a huge compost operation, farming sustainably and fairly, and funding community development projects, and it's really cool. And then palm oil is another major raw material of ours, and palm is like the worst. And palm has a well-deserved and a horrible reputation for what's happening in Indonesia and Borneo, and the way the plantations go in and they rip up virgin rainforest and orangutan habitats destroyed and communities are uprooted, and it's horrible. But there's nothing about palm oil intrinsically that's bad. Like hemp, gets associated, it's all good, but there's plenty of ways of farmers who are growing hemp in a very unregenerative and bad way. And palm can be totally regenerative. And in Ghana, what we're doing is we're working with smallholder farmers in Ghana growing palm, and for our bar soaps. We need palm oil for the bar soaps for the hardness. But what we're doing there is practicing dynamic ag forestry. So going into the regenerative in a perennial system, in a tree cropping system, in an annual system, it's all about smart crop rotations. But the equivalent in a perennial tree crop is, when you look at a wild ecosystem, you have the tall trees and the mid-level trees and the bushes.
Right.
And if you can get complementary crops that can replicate those different canopy heights, maximize your photosynthetic capture, double the yields. So what we're doing palm, banana, cassava, or palm, cocoa, banana, and cassava. And so cassava's on the ground, bananas kind of shades the cocoa, and then the palms are tall. So if you were to do monoculture blocks of each of those in the same area as a dynamic—
Oh my gosh, it would be devastating. They would just rip out more forest.
Well, and the yield and the weed and pest pressure is enormous in the monocultures. Right. The yields are half as much as when you do dynamic ag forestry. It's knowledge intensive, not chemical intensive. It's knowledge intensive. You have to understand the distance, see how those canopies fill in. You have to make sure you have the right, planting distances and everything. But if you do it right and you're pruning, you're putting so much biomass back into the earth. Your yields are doubled. Your incomes are doubled. It's just so much better for the farmers, for the land, for revitalizing rural economies. So that's what we're doing now in Ghana.
Love that, David. That, I wanted to just say a little something here for folks who may not understand some terms that we're using, like agroforestry, for example, because agroforestry is such a brilliant approach, particularly, as you were saying, into perennial cropping. And when you do that, when you think about how a rainforest is so vital and productive, and you have plants growing at, as you were saying, all these different levels, from the ground all the way into the high canopy, and to be bringing an agricultural lens to that and to create a cropping system that's integrated, obviously, I would assume that this also provides habitat for birds and other animals. And like you're creating a restoration also of a more dynamic ecosystem.
Exactly. I mean, that's like the whole goal of our farming. Like, we need to transition our farming globally to replicate natural ecosystems. Like, there is no chemical inputs. It's completely self-regenerating. Like, how do we farm in nature's image? And exactly, in a perennial system, it's like you introduce those complementary crops that replicate the different kind of ecosystem niches that trees in the wild or an ecosystem would have. And when you do that, you create biodiverse habitat for wildlife, and just huge amounts of biomass is being sequestered into the ground. You're boosting.
Are there any animals integrated into these systems at all? Any sort of kind of in the more biodynamic orientation where you have some integration of animals? If so, what has been introduced in this system that you're speaking of?
Well, I mean, we're working with traditional farmers primarily, so it depends where we're at. But like, I mean, it's more like goat herders will kind of just roam through,
right?
And you know, they pay a fee and then they'll just kind of go through and graze, and that kind of helps reduce the weed pressure and all that. So it's kind of more of like a, you know, it's relatively small plots, but then there's this kind of overall kind of cool integration of livestock and kind of coming through. And and it's kind of sad.
So it's a community centric model. It sounds like
it's community centric, but I'll tell you, I was just in Ghana last September. And so you see all this like totally regenerative meat. It's like, wow, these animals are like completely adding to the food supply. You know, they're part of an integrated system. But what's super sad is that so much of the meat people are eating in the developing world is now being supplied by the developed world. It's like all the dark meat, all the shit we don't want to eat gets dumped into the third world, in the developing world, at prices below what is a completely regenerative supply locally.
Oh,
and
wow.
Really disrupting the whole markets. And you know, and the animals that we're raising are being raised on GMO corn and soy, you know, in cages in a completely unregenerative system. But anyways, you know, leaving that alone, like when on the ground, you can, you know, it's like really beautiful, and it is a regenerative system, and the livestock are in a balance. Like you look at a wild ecosystem and there's a sustainable balance of plant and animal life, and they work together. And that's what we want to see. And so it's basically, how do you, you know, like we need to reduce our diet and our diets. We need to drastically reduce the amount of meat, milk, and eggs to a sustainable level. Like with that population of animals, you know, even though I'm vegan, I'm in solidarity with the high animal welfare pasture-based operators. You know, we're allies against the machine, right?
I appreciate that, David, because there's so much acrimony sometimes between the vegan community and the role that animals play in our ecosystem, and particularly in grassland restoration. If you think back to how many buffalo were actually roaming the West and the grasslands, millions of these animals were moving through almost like a savanna-like space. So thank you for being respectful of the balance that we need, and I totally concur. The size and the persistence of how much people are consuming really needs to be shifted dramatically towards.
Yeah, regenerative meats. It's the single, regenerative meat, milk, and dairy. I mean, it's the single most important part of the equation, is that because animals magnify one way or the other. So because of the kind of inefficient conversion of plant protein and carbohydrates and animal protein and carbohydrate, that if you're doing the wrong thing, like growing GMO corn and soy, like that's bad. And then if you feed it to an animal, now it's like, you know, 10 times worse, right?
Right. Because it's not even their natural diet, which is.
Well, and it takes 10 times. And then, but when you eat that GMO fed beef, now it's like 10 times more. I mean, if I had just eaten that GMO corn in the first place, I would have eaten 10% of it than what it took to make that GMO fed feedlot beef, you know? And like, you really need to get the grass fed, you know, that's the thing. But if it's grass fed, now you're like, you're taking care of the grasslands and regenerating land if you're doing it correctly. And like, so that's, you know, so like Will Harris, like these Next Level Ranches, you know, Gabe Brown, these are the, you know, the kind of superheroes showing, like, these are how you integrate livestock responsibly. So basically as a society, we need to drastically reduce the number of livestock, get them out of their cages and integrated back on our farmlands in an integrated, you know, pasture cropping systems. You know, that's the future.
I agree. You know, I think for people who are curious about what that looks like in actual practice, I think the film Biggest Little Farm is a great lens into how, you know, animals play this extraordinary balancing role, both the wild and the domesticated. And that film, I think, does a beautiful job of creating that, a very picturesque insight into how these things can weave together in a very balanced, healthy, restorative way.
Yeah, and as much as I like that film, I think the film that I just watched, Dreaming of a Better World, I don't know if you've seen Dreaming of a Better
World. I haven't seen Dreaming of a Better World.
Oh man, it's amazing, and it's about David Vedder. So he was...
I love David.
Yeah, so his farm is like this oasis out in, where is it, Nebraska?
Nebraska, yeah.
And it's like in this like monoculture desert of corn and soy, GMO corn and soy, and it's like this, you know, diversified 9-year rotation of, you know, just corn and soy, and I forgot all the different elements, but then he goes into 5 years of pasture. He goes 5 years of pasture and 4 years of cropping, and it'll be like corn, soy, something, I forget. But it's a really smart rotation, like each rotation like sets up the next one and, you know, reduces the weed pressure and pest pressure, and he does rotational grazing on the pasture, and just his soil health is just out of control. No fertility, no nothing. Not even outside compost, not even organic, omri, anything from outside his farm. It's just completely self-generated fertility.
Exactly. You know, Bob Quinn also is doing a 9-year rotation on his farm. Do you know Bob?
Yeah, right on.
Another one of those just pioneer men in our community who are need to be replicated broadly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, and I think just on the subject of livestock, so I think ruminants really, you know, play a key role in a regenerative system. You know, that they can graze, you know, when you have nitrogen fixing cover crops on, you know, resting soil, you know, they can graze and, you know, just generally speed the biology of the system and just help, you know, promote it. But monogastrics, like the chickens and the pigs, that's a different story. And even on regenerative ranches, like the sources of their feed is oftentimes not regenerative. And like I often like say this, if I waved a magic wand and got all the pigs and the chickens out of their cages and onto the land, that doesn't change. If we don't change their diet, nothing changes, because of a chicken on pasture will at most get like 25% of its diet from like worms and seeds and stuff. It's still mostly a grain fed animal.
Right.
And it has a higher metabolism, and it takes as much grain to get the slaughter weight as a CAFO animal. So like we need to like take responsibility for, like, nothing will change on those monoculture deserts of soy and corn just because you get the pigs and chickens out of their cages. Like, we need to like also take responsibility for how that their feed crops are being grown. And then the alfalfa, you know, we're GMOing alfalfa. I mean, most of our agriculture is feed crops. It's alfalfa, it's soy, and it's corn being fed.
You know, I just want to interject here a moment elsewhere. I think this is another thing that many of us in the American marketplace do not know, how huge the percentage of land in agricultural production in the United States is actually in feed production and or some other commodity that actually is not directly food.
Yeah, that whole, like, you know, idea that, oh, we're feeding the world with GMO corn or, you know, and soy. It's like, no, we're like, GMO corn is, I think 12% of it's going to human food. Half of it's going to ethanol, like this complete boondoggle of corn-based.
Totally. Ethanol.
And then the rest is animal feed, and soy is similar. It's like 80% animal feed, you know, and it's not, you know, it's not, we're not feeding people with this. We're feeding, yeah.
And we're feeding animals in torturous conditions. So it's a really, it's a very confused system that we have right now. And it's lost its way, as you and I both are advocates for another path. We love the word regenerative because it says so much to me, the word regenerative. It captures in its very frame the idea that you're making something better than it was, and that it is in a long-term, you know, an increasing state of good, of health and well-being, when you regenerate. and sustainability being more of a flat plane. And of course, what we really have is a degenerative extractive system that's doing, making things much, much worse, and moves the dependency to synthetic inputs and all the other mess that we've been talking about into higher need, because the landscape has been really denuded of life.
Yeah, totally. And that's like, you know, and when you bring regenerative agricultural principles to bear on like completely debilitated land, like, you know, like so much of our agricultural landscapes that are just destroyed, like the soil, like we've been treating it like a you know, dead dirt, like an inert medium to hold up our crops that we bring to harvest with more and more chemicals, instead of treating it as a vibrant living ecosystem that if you feed that soil and treat it right, it's going to produce all the food we need in a much more intense way. So when you start bringing those regenerative management to that destroyed soil, like relatively quickly in 5 to 10 years, you can basically completely restore healthy soil function and you know, bring that biology back and you know, the natural cycling of nutrients and the amount of carbon that is in that soil, like, you know, when it's dead dirt, I mean, it's all that soil organic matter has been oxidized up in the atmosphere, and 1/3 of excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is from mismanaged soils. But when you start to manage them correctly and you restart that biology and that cycling, and you know, the roots are feeding the carbohydrates into the soil microbiome, and you know, everything's working, and you know, that's, I'm sure your audience knows this, but I mean, it's just like when you talk to people about the basics of photosynthesis, it's like, you know, we're, all of us are made out of carbon from air. It's the car, you know, it's about carbon dioxide through photosynthesis become carbohydrates and make the root shoots and leaves. But 20 to 40% of that is fed into the soil to feed all that life, and all that life locks up carbon and just, you know, locks carbon in recalcitrant humus form. And when we do that and we do farm correctly, in 5 to 10 years, it's like bringing a forest back to life. Like the amount of carbon, you know, like you're just like reforesting that farmland by just farming correctly.
And you know, that, what excites me, David, is like, this is what is so, I think, inspiring for people who are worried about climate change, who feel helpless and hopeless about all of the very stark news that we keep hearing daily, you know, how much ice just melted in Greenland because of such high temperatures, and on and on. There's just an endless barrage of what feels for many of us like, what the heck can we do? And what I love about the regenerative conversation is that we're not talking decades for recovery and restoration. It's a relatively short period of time to shift the health and well-being of land when you come towards it with this regenerative practice as your guide. And I think that's very hopeful.
Right on, yeah, totally. And that's like, you know, we feel like what we're doing with our dynamic ag forestry, or it's also called multi-strata ag forestry, you know, it's like, we didn't pioneer this at all. I mean, this has been around for decades, but we're part of this like wave of like kind of bringing it to the next level and just really starting a revolution. And like, dude, like, you want to solve that cocoa problem that's like, you know, a coffee problem, like start doing dynamic interplanting. I mean, problem solved. And, you know, we're hoping like relatively quickly in the coming 10 years, you know, this is going to just really catch on like wildfire. And, you know, and actually, and the Regenerative Organic Alliance, like we're, David Vetter is kind of retiring from the board. He's just kind of too busy and taking care of things, and he's doing all kinds of stuff. And so the guy who's going to replace him is Kat Alfred. He's an Austrian farmer. I forget his last name, but super high level, and networked in with like just some top universities there on regenerative. And talking to him, he's like, you know, in Austria, 25% of farmland is organic. What? 25%? He's like, yeah, man, it just like took off. I mean, we're just on the revolution. And it was just like, wow, you know, like a country like Austria, it's like not insignificant size, like to be able to like, you know, that quickly have that ethic permeate. And so, you know, you just, there's hope, you know, at some point, you know, we just, hopefully a switch just gets flipped And there's some different bottlenecks in America. You know, there's like the generational kind of transfer, land transfer, and just the chemical companies, you know, their iron grip on our regulatory agencies and our academic institutions. But this like grassroots regenerative revolution, you know, I feel like as it takes hold and just kind of reaches some tipping points, pretty quickly we can start to regenerate like huge amounts of farmland.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I feel like some of the conversation, you know, and we host the Regenerative Earth Summit, and part of the conversation that we're having in these summits is how do we improve the quality of life for farmers in this country by helping introduce regenerative principles so that their actual financial success is improved because they're spending less money on all of those toxic inputs. And as they restore soil health and move into more diverse cropping systems, they also increase their revenue opportunities through different crops. So I'm particularly heartened by what looks to me to be some uptake in the more conventional farming community about what this could mean for you know, large systems to shift towards these more multi-crop systems, rotational systems,
that
have not dominated the game.
No, totally. And that's, you know, I mean, there's more and more of these farmers like come over to the regenerative side of the equation. And I think, you know, there's just a fair amount of inertia out there, but, you know, as more and more of our champions kind of spread and inspire others, you know, just I think the momentum is really building. And I think a lot of these farmers are like, you know, like Gabe Brown, unfortunately a lot of them need to kind of, you know, he's very honest, he's like, you know, I was in crisis, you know, I had to do something, you know, I lost my crops 3 years in a row to hail and drought, and you know, and he was kind of forced to flip. And but hopefully we, you know, as more and more momentum, it's we'll just kind of, you know, just convince farmers to do it before they're totally at the
end. Before they're in like a really dire situation. Yeah. I agree. Although there's a lot of farmers in
dire straits
circumstances right now. And this is another thing I think is interesting with the hemp piece as another opportunity in agriculture in the United States for farmers to be able to grow hemp as part of their diversity.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Hemp's on fire, man. It's crazy. The CBD revolution is real. And I think there's some like 350,000 acres of hemp were contracted this year. And it's,
I'm also interested in the fiber side too, like moving it into replacing corn in bioplastics, replacing trees in press board, and replacing different packaging materials by using hemp fiber. I don't know where that is in your lexicon, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts about sort of the blend of both the hemp fiber as well as the CBD, as well as the, you know, the food side, the fiber side.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us got into hemp because of the fiber, the promise of fiber for all that, you know, kind of replacing cotton and textiles and timber for paper as energy. And, you know, unfortunately, like Europe's way ahead of North America in terms of its hemp fiber processing infrastructure. You know, North America initially was a kind of seed-driven market for hemp, and then it became a CBD-driven market. But hopefully we're getting to a scale where the fiber can really start to get traction.
Mm.
A lot of those really exciting fiber opportunities can present.
So I have another kind of close to closing question for you. How do we bring this kind of the regenerative story to people in the marketplace as a way of both educating them on what this is, but also increasing the demand so that the makers of things have to meet a growing demand on the consumer side? How do you see that happening, or what are some ideas you might have?
Definitely regenerative organic certification is like a big program, consumer facing program we're putting a lot of energy into, and we're in the pilot phase and should be commercially launched in, you know, early next year. And we'll be, you know, coordinating with Patagonia and other allies, and in our, you know, we got the Guayaquil's and Numi Teas and just some really high level brands and ranches and farms in our pilot. And you're going to make a big splash of, you know, really being in stores, talking to consumers about regenerative practices. I think policy changes, like, and you know, right now, unfortunately, you could be doing the worst possible things as far as farming GMO corn and soy in a completely unregenerative, you know, corn back-to-back-to-back, GMO, blasting pesticides and fertilizers. No matter what happens, the government's going to give you money.
Right.
You know, like, we need to change the policy incentives so that we're not incentivizing the worst agricultural practices, but the best. So, and that's starting to happen. So, like, different allies are lobbying for different changes to, you know, and you got to be careful, you know, in a right-left coalition. Like, even though, of course, regenerative agriculture is great for climate change and mitigating it, you know, talking more in terms of soil health and farmer income is maybe the better messaging. But anyways, that's all happening. We're starting to get like some really, you know, some better policies. I mean, it's still a disaster generally, but we're starting to incrementally make some inroads, federal and state levels for healthy soil and regenerative programs. And then I told you I was going to get psychedelics in here somehow.
Okay.
Yeah. But we're hard at work. We feel like there's going to be a new roar in 20s. Like, we're going to end cannabis prohibition in 2020. We have 20 more states, cannabis prohibition is over. 2021, we're going to integrate MDMA for treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder via FDA approval. Psilocybin is close behind. And psilocybin is like a very powerful traditional psychedelic. It's what's in magic mushrooms. But very powerful medicine for depression and addiction and other mental health conditions that our traditional pharma is just scratching the surface. And bringing these more indigenous ways of healing and knowing and relating to each other in the world and self.
Yes.
This is going to be, I think, a huge part of the shift in consciousness that needs to happen for people to really just take responsibility for what they're consuming, what they're eating. You know, like our plate as a farm, or fork's a pitchfork, a knife's a butchering knife, and just understanding that, you know, what we choose on our plate, like what, you know, there's a farm making that food, and is that a regenerative farm or is that a degenerative farm, and taking responsibility for what our section of the garden looks like, and, you know, making sure we're supporting the farmers doing it right and regenerating the earth. So that shift in consciousness, you know, hopefully it's not automatic. I mean, psychedelics are not an automatic magic bullet, but just as a part of the equation, I think there's real hope, but alongside the knowledge and the wisdom that, you know, all of us need to be putting forward. And so, I don't know, hopefully a combination of all these factors, and people really start to wake up, and, you know, just some, you know, wake up in time so that we don't go off the climate change cliff here.
And absolute. Yeah. And, you know what, I hope that, you know, we shift out of the false notion of separation.
Right on. Yeah.
And that we move into the recognition that, as you guys say so beautifully, we're all one. And it's one planet, it's a living system. We are part of that living system. We share life with many other forms. We've been at war with a lot of life forms because we have perceived them as at odds with our goals and objectives. But as we are now sort of staring down the, as you said, you know, this huge loss of diversity of life on our planet with species extinction, and then our own species being at risk with what we've done over a long period of time of disrupting the lungs and organs of our living planet by destroying forests and wetlands and croplands, being degrading, you know, destroying soil health. It's almost a wake up call. And if you're really not hearing that call, I don't understand it.
Yeah, no, I know, man. But come on, everybody.
Come on, everybody. Yeah, let's do this together. So, David, thank you so much for joining me today on Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast, and sharing the story of the sort of the early beginnings of Dr. Bronner's, and then we didn't get to everything because there's just so much to talk about with Dr. Bronner's and with you in particular, so many of the incredible initiatives you're doing in Ghana and Sri Lanka, and how you all are just such a audaciously visionary and heartfully driven company. I salute you.
Yeah, right on, Celine. Thank you, and salute you back. So, thank you for rocking, and the Regenerative Earth Summit is really, and that's another really beautiful, these conferences bringing together the best of the movement, talking to each other, and strategizing, inspiring, and creating awareness.
Thank you.
It's a super.
It's a team effort.
Right on. Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. Great.
We'll rock on and have a great weekend.
Thank you
so much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast series is produced by At the Epicenter, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The podcast and video recordings are made possible by the generous support of people like you. Make a tax-deductible donation or sign up as a monthly supporter by visiting attheepicenter.com/donate. Support packages start at $1 per month. The podcast series is also sponsored by several corporate and organization sponsors. To become a podcast sponsor, visit attheepicenter.com/contact to let us know of your interest. If you found this podcast episode insightful and meaningful, please pass it on by sharing it with a friend or colleague who will also enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in, for your support, and for activating change.